Welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series.
Relationship Manifesto podcast series. Welcome back, boys and girls. My name's Chris Smith, Shambles Guru on the interweb. I'm with Stephen Whitehead.
Hi, Chris. Hello, Steve. Got your cold?
Yeah. I still brought my cold back again. And this is episode 44.
44.
And you should have, you know, I'm surprised you didn't predict I'd still have a cold, because this episode is all about
predictions.
And before, but before we get into that, we said in the last podcast we'd have a look on Google to see how many, what was the greatest number of wives somebody had had, right? Mm. And so I've done a little search on Google. You know, I spent hours searching this. The world is an absolutely bananas place. It is. There's a newspaper article here from the Mail Online. It does go back a bit to 2006. And the headlines are, man who had 80 wives and 250 children.
Amazing.
Which is absolutely bananas. What is even more bananas is that's not all it says on the title of the newspaper article. It says, man who had 80 wives and 250 children is arrested on rape charges. He needs it cut off. Look, British government, cut his dick off. And what am I doing? Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
No, you shouldn't. Let me get back.
Wait, I've got two more. Sorry, oh, Steve. I have to share these. I'm sorry. There was another one where most children born.
I thought we were doing this for a special podcast.
Oh, we will, but I can't resist these two. I'll do these two. There's thousands of these, I'm sure.
Well, just limit it to two, Chris. Okay.
The most children born to one woman. The greatest officially recorded number of children born to one mother, one at a time, 69 children.
Mm.
She didn't need much relationship manifesto coaching, did she? Or did she? No, what do you think? You know, it's...
I can't get my head around it. I'm somewhere else at the moment. I'm trying to get on with the podcast. Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, this is the podcast. We're being impromptu. One last one. I have to do one last one. It says, world largest family is in Mizoram. I don't know where Mizoram is.
No idea.
Sounds like it's sort of Middle Eastern, doesn't it? Over 100 kids. One man, 50 wives, over 100 kids. Wow. I bet he didn't have much change at the end of out of his pay packet at the end of the month. Doesn't it boggle you, all those?
Nothing surprises me about people.
Well, just the stamina.
Yeah, sure.
God, imagine all sitting around the table. Okay, predictions.
Okay, before we get into predictions, I want to just make three corrections to previous podcasts or adjustments to previous podcasts. The first one, thanks to Trey Dobson in Tokyo. On the Tokyo podcast, I mistakenly said that the stir to let people know you're interested in them was between 30 and 60 seconds. Well, clearly that was wrong. What was actually, and Trey put me right on this, the stir to let people know you're interested in them is 3 seconds worldwide, but only 1.5 seconds duration in Japan, which signifies or indicates the cultural constraints against people in Japan, Japanese, observing each other. That's why you, as I said in the podcast, you get a lot of people, a lot of Japanese avoiding eye contact. So 1.5 seconds, if you're in Japan and you're looking to make contact with a member of the same sex or opposite sex, and you've got 1.5 seconds, that's all you need to do it. And interest is registered, apparently. Thanks for that, Trey. Second one is, we talked about... previous podcast just recently we talked about the code breaker, the gay mathematician, British guy who was convicted of gross indecency in the early 1950s. Well, we've checked that out, and it's actually come up on the news this week. His name was Alan Turing, and Alan is actually being celebrated in royal stamps that are coming out this coming year. So this, the Second World War codebreaker Alan Turing is being celebrated by a special stamp as an online petition calls for posthumous pardon to quash his conviction for gross indecency. This guy was really something, because he's only one of 10 people chosen for the Royal Mail's Britons of Distinction stamps to be launched in February. But he's particularly important because he was part of the team that cracked the Enigma code at Bletchley Park, and he went on to help create the world's first modern computer, which incidentally was in Manchester. So for all of those of you who don't realise it, the first computer was actually built up in Manchester University. And this year marks the centenary of his birth. Turing was convicted of gross indecency in 1952, at a time when homosexual acts were still illegal in the UK, and he was sentenced to chemical castration. He either had the choice of chemical castration or prison. He chose chemical castration. But unfortunately, tragically, he killed himself 2 years later by taking cyanide. But in 2009, the then Prime Minister Gordon Brown issued an unequivocal apology on behalf of the government to Turing, describing his treatment as horrifying and utterly unfair. And Brown quite rightly said that the country owed him a huge debt. So that's the bit on Turing. And thirdly, correction that was brought to my attention by Catherine Chen in Taiwan. This relates to the podcast in Taiwan. The first gay parade in Taiwan was not 2003. As I said, it was actually 1999. Okay, those out of the way.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Chemical castration.
That sounds nasty.
Is this you take some chemical orally and then it affects your
testosterone? Yeah, it's effectively reduces your testosterone levels to very little, and it's a sort of hormone that you might get available here in Thailand as part of, for ladyboys who are going, or young men who want to become ladyboys. It's part of this conversion to femininity, if you like. Now, I don't know all the mechanics of it that were operating in 1952. Having said that, it's still offered to prisoners in the UK today, prisoners who have been convicted of sexual offences. They can't. I don't think it's on the statute books as a requirement that somebody undergoes chemical castration, but certainly in the UK today, child molesters, people who've got paedophiles, or people who've been convicted of sexual crime, if it's considered that it's in their own interest, if you like, to undergo chemical castration, and that can still be done, but it has to have, it has to be done with their consent. The thing to bear in mind about Alan Turing, he did consent to it, but he was given the choice. It was either that or jail. But the tragedy is that it was ever brought to that, and obviously the fact that the reality in those days, which isn't that long ago, let's be honest, when homosexuality was still a crime. And on that point about homosexuality being a crime, you know, we've still got, even today in the more enlightened era, 21st century, at the beginning of it, we've got 80 countries around the world that still criminalise LGBT people. And in 10 of those countries, you can be given a death sentence for being gay. Which is going to be one of the things I'm going to pick up on the predictions, which I'll get into. What I'm looking at is the sort of trends that I'm seeing in terms of relationships and sexuality and identity over the next 12 months. And we can look at, to pick up the trends, we can see what's happening in and around the world. And the big trend that I'm seeing is an increase in polarisation between liberals and conservatives. I think that's been played out. It has been played out, I know, for a while in British and American politics, but I think we're going to see it become even more polarised over this coming election year in the States. But this big polarisation between those who've got a liberal attitude, liberal approach, liberal perspective, liberal value system, particularly around sexuality and relationships, and those who are going in the opposite direction, almost as going in reverse, if you like, as a statement of resistance. They're becoming more radical. Let me start with the sort of good news first. I mean, this comes from Spain. Now, Spain's not been known over the last century as being a liberal place. I mean, it was occupied by it was ruled by Franco for a long time, and it was a fascist dictator. So you couldn't expect to be a particularly liberal country. Having said after that, But things are changing in Spain, and this was some an article that I picked up, and this is in Madrid, and it's a Madrid suburb has ceded land for a project for a gay retirement home, a retirement home where gay LGBT people can go. And I'm going to quote from this. A group of elderly Spanish gay men are rebelling against the homophobia of their generation by setting up what will be the country's first gay and lesbian retirement home. Quote, homosexuals who go into homes often also have to go straight back into the closet, said Federico Armenteros, the man behind the scheme. This will be a place that is open to everyone and where no one will have to hide their sexuality. In a country where many people over 40 grew up being taught that gay people were sick or criminals, the atmosphere in some retirement homes in Spain is still crudely homophobic. Armenteros, who heads a gay and lesbian NGO called December 26, has already found a site for this new complex, this new retirement complex. It's in a Madrid dormitory town. And it'll apparently, he goes on to say, it's going to have a gym, lawn, library, laundrette, and even have its own shop and restaurant. And it'll be apparently lower price than most of the average Madrid retirement homes. It will also set aside room for people who are HIV positive, because he says most retirement homes in Spain won't even allow HIV positive elderly people in. But Armenteros also insists that it would not only be a place for gay, lesbian or transsexual people, it's also going to be a place of a space of tolerance where anybody can come, which I think is very important. So we've got this significant change here. And it's this news has gone all around the world, and it. But the fact that a gay and lesbian retirement home—it's such a new concept in Europe. And apparently, his NGO and the town hall that's passed this project have been receiving calls from potential residents from as far away as Switzerland. He said a Spaniard living in Switzerland who planned to retire soon saw it on the television there and rang me. He was very enthusiastic. So. What you've got here, let's wrap it up. You've got a retirement home for elderly people who would have been living most of their life in a very homophobic atmosphere in a particular country that was had a strong fascist history, that is Spain. Mm. So that's a major change. And we're seeing more of that. If you pick out the bits of change to a more liberal attitude and liberal approach, it's very positive. And I see that's one of my predictions of 2012. We're going to see more of this. That's the good news.
Do you think that's global, or do you think it's European or North American or Asian?
It's obviously in resistance in some parts, in some countries, and it's in resistance in every country in part. But I see this as a global shift. If you think about these ideas as having their own virus, their own contagion, their own ability to surface anywhere in the world, on the internet, in newspapers, like it's done here. You know, I'm talking about it here in Thailand. This is something that's kicking off in Madrid. Nowadays, knowledge can't be bounded by geographical space or boundaries. It's fluid. And this sort of knowledge, which is a more liberal and tolerant approach to people who don't fit the compulsory heterosexual norm, if you like. I think that's going to happen. That's happening. But the converse of that is, sadly, is that those people who feel threatened by it, those individuals who feel threatened by this emergent liberal discourse, liberal attitude, liberal values, those people who are threatened by it for whatever reason, I think they're going to become more resistant. They're going to become more vocal. I also think they're going to become more violent. So my other prediction is that we're going to see more hate crimes against gays, lesbians, gays particularly, gay men particularly, and transsexuals around the world. I think we're going to see more. Unfortunately, I think it's a trend. I think it's inevitable, really, because we're coming to a point in history of which 2012 is only a small bit. We're talking about a long epoch here of change that certainly kicked off at the beginning of the 20th century and we're still in it. Change towards more liberal attitudes and more opening of sexual possibilities for individuals, and clearly in terms of relationships also. But the converse of that is some people don't like it. They get angry. And we're seeing an increase in hate crimes in the UK. We're seeing an increase in hate crimes in the US and other parts of the world. And we're also seeing some countries become more illiberal, more traditional, more conservative. Some parts of Africa, the Middle East, they're trying to resist this tsunami of liberalism, because I think liberalism's will win in the end, but there's going to be a lot of pain and grief and suffering before we get to that point.
But this is not just gender, though, is it?
No, I'm talking. I think I'm not. When I talk about liberalism, I'm talking about particularly. I'm thinking about movements against sexism, racism, the discrimination on any basis, on religion, on
economics.
Well, economic liberalism, I think you can. I don't want to get into that, because I think you could be a follower of. I think you. I mean, we've got a situation at the moment in America where this. I think his name Santorum, is it, who's just come out as the possible one of the Republican candidates to face off with Obama. From what I've read about this guy, who suddenly emerged from nowhere in the Ohio, constituencies, elections. He's very liberal in economically. He's in favour of big government. So in that respect, he's just like Miliband here in Miliband in the UK, the Labour leader, or Clegg, the Liberal leader, or even Obama. But on the other side, on personal level, he's very illiberal. He's very traditional conservative. He's against abortion of any type, even abortion where rape's been involved or incest. So the two don't mix. You can operate. You can have a liberal attitude in terms of economics, but you can be very. You can still be sexist and racist and against personal freedoms of the individual. So I think the economics is a slightly different debate. But as I say, first prediction: we're going to see more movements towards liberalism. Spain, I'm just offering that as one example, and it's important, and I welcome it. We're going to see an increase in LGBT awareness and this ongoing liberalisation of attitudes. But second prediction, an increase in hate crimes. I want to back that up by some data that, again, has come out only in the last couple of weeks. You know, we've in previous podcasts we talked about violence in America and guns. Well, would you believe it? The Americans bought a record number of guns this Christmas. Now, if you buy a gun in America, you've got to have a background check, and the background checks are done by the FBI. Now, I don't know the mechanics of it, but you can buy any number of guns, but at one time, but you've got to have a background check to be a valid purchaser. So, in December alone. This December just gone, the FBI did 1.5 million background checks. We're requested to do 1.5 million background checks on individuals. That's 1.5 million different people buying guns for Christmas, would you believe? In the 6 days before Christmas, half a million. And on the 23rd of December alone, there were 102,000, just over. So this is background checks on customers buying weapons that kill people. We're not talking about knives. We're talking about anything from an AK-47 to a Colt pistol or something. And it's up a quarter on the previous year. Now, that's depressing, isn't it? I find it amusing, but I find it makes me angry and it makes me depressed at the same time. It makes me pity Americans. I really do think you're a completely fucked up nation. But anyway, that aside.
Yeah, it makes me not
want to go to America, I know.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. And I forget, sorry, all my American friends, and I've got a lot of them. I love you, you're beautiful, wonderful people, but you've got amongst you some real head cases. I know you know that yourself. I want to quote from the Bradley campaign to end gun violence, and it's just a quick quote, but it's interesting, this quote. Because according to the Bradley campaign, which is an American-based voluntary organization, charity, aiming to reduce gun violence in America, they say this, their data, and this is up-to-date data, their data says fewer and fewer Americans are owning more and more guns. So what's interesting, according to that statement, is not that more Americans than ever are buying guns, but there's a hardcore of Americans who are buying more and more guns. Now, this comes back to this second prediction about the rise in conservatism, well, it's more than conservatism, it's almost a radical resistance against liberalism. Because I would venture to say, and I may be wrong here in many instances, but I would venture to say that a lot of the people who are going out and buying guns for Christmas and giving them as Christmas presents, they're not liberals. They're not people who are comfortable with difference. I think there's a lot of anger, a lot of hate, a lot of aggression within these individuals. Some of them will be psychotic. Some of them will be normal, everyday people. They might be just people who are afraid of violence themselves, who are living in a neighbourhood where there's violence, or just worried about getting robbed and having the throat cut at night. I don't know. But the point is, I think if you've got a house full of guns, that's not a setting for a house full of liberal attitudes. I don't think the two go together. Get rid of the guns, buy the books. But people don't do that, do they? So I think that's my second prediction. This rise in hate crimes against liberals, against LGBT people.
Be interesting to know whether people bought the guns. You know, when you talked about it, I assumed they were buying guns for themselves. And then you said to give us Christmas presents. I wonder if they were
being given away or just buying them for themselves. I don't think they know, really. The data I've got doesn't reveal that. But the fact is that Christmas suggests there's a link with Christmas spending. It's clearly Christmas spending, whether that's present giving, but, you know, giving somebody a gun for Christmas.
Season of goodwill, right?
Season of goodwill is something going to blow your head off. It's sick, you know, but, you know, when we can't see it's sick, then we've got a problem. If we can stand back and see it's sick and see that it points to a cancer in society, that's fine. But if we can't do that anymore, if we've lost sight of values, if we lost some core values here, then...
But you're assuming... wouldn't somebody else in the other corner say that, I'm just buying this for self-defence?
Yeah, sure.
I'm not going to be aggressive.
Yeah, no,
but
sure.
I want to have a gun in the house because our neighbours were actually...
Well, you're not. The point is, you don't have a gun unless you're prepared to use it. You know, if you're going to point a gun at someone, you're going to be the sort of person that's going to point a gun at someone and not have bullets in it. So you're just going to be a standoff. It's going to be a show of strength without anything behind it. No, these people will buy the bullets as well. I mean, how many of these people are buying guns without the bullets? Now, if they're buying guns without the bullets, fine. But are they buying guns without the bullets? Absolutely not. They're buying the bullets. They put the bullet in, that's meant to do harm. So I don't go with it that it's just about defence, because as soon as you point a gun at someone, you pull the trigger, it's no longer defence. That's an act of aggression. That's killing someone. That's blowing someone's arm off or head.
But surely, if they're about to shoot you, it is defence, isn't it?
But the point is, you've got a situation where people are buying guns in order to ratchet up the defence. At the end of the day, you'll end up with a situation in America where people are living in fortresses surrounded by armed guards, and you've got dozens of fortresses in one township, and that's already starting to emerge, where you've got their own little mafia guarding the fortresses. We're seeing that in South America already. Mm-hmm. You stop the trend. The answer is not to buy more guns. You end up, you know, what's the next neighbour going to have? We're going to have a tank? You know, flamethrowers? This is how societies break down. This is the beginning of the end of societies when they're starting to fight like this. This is what we went through during the 20th century, mm-hmm. where, you know, at the end of the day, you start off with families killing each other. Then it develops, you've got countries killing each other. Then you've got countries wiping each other out with nuclear weapons. Stop it. So... You know, anyway.
The right to bear arms.
The right to bear arms. Yeah, the right to kill someone. Sick, but anyway, there we go. The third prediction is we're going to see a rise in what I'm calling electro-babble. And I did a blog on this recently, this week, actually.
Sorry, I'm just smiling because it's a breath of fresh air not to hear somebody say that a rise in techno-babble. So this is electo-babble.
Well, techno-babble, electro-babble. It's just a decline. I think I see it as it's something I picked up with a very good article that was in one of the papers. And it was this guy I wrote about, he was writing about the decline in conversation skills. And I think... I think we're seeing that. I think more and more people, because of the computer, because of the internet, are losing conversational skills. This is quoted. This, again, is supported by this guy called Barnaby Lennon, who's chairman of the Independent Schools Council in the UK. And he's saying young people's reading and conversation skills are being put at risk because of their overexposure to technology. And we can take a position on this, but it my position would be that I don't think technology is increasing people's intelligence. I think it's reducing people's intelligence. I don't think they're necessarily learning a lot from the internet. I think they're certainly not learning how to speak. They might be learning touch skills, and we can see that, touch typing skills, fine, that's a skill in itself. But the art of conversation, dialogue, discourse between other human beings on a face-to-face forum, I think is under threat. The other thing I want to say here is that I want to counter that, because I had an interesting conversation. Although I believe that's happening, I don't think it's inevitable. And that's the bad news, that people are obsessed by gadgets, smartphones, iPhones, and whatever. But the good news is, I think there's a lot of young people now who are coming off it. And I had an interesting conversation with my 16-year-old son, Robert, yesterday, who's in the UK. And I was asking him how he's getting on. He's on holiday now at school, him and his sister, till the middle of next week. And he said, well, the thing is, I'm taking this time to go back to reading. And I said, what are you reading? He said, I'm reading books, Dad. He told me the sort of books he's reading. He's halfway through Stepford Wives, and he's just finished a book called Millennium Man. And he's reading good level literature. He's a bright guy, but he's doing it voluntarily. He's not doing it because I've told him to, or his mother's told him to. He's doing it because he wants to do it. So I said, well, what about Facebook? And Robert was a very keen follower of Facebook. And he's saying, I'm coming off it. It's getting boring. He says something revealing. He said, a lot of kids under me, my age, are addicted to it. He's talking about his people below his age, particularly at school. But he says, a lot of me and my mates, we don't do it so much. We're still on it, but we're not doing it as much. So I think there's a warning sign coming up here. If that's typical, I'm okay. That's only one anecdote. But if that's being replicated around the world, and he's a bright young guy, Robert's, you know, wants to go back to reading and not Kindle, he wants to read proper books, and he's doing that, then I think that's very good.
I'm just having a wry smile at the term proper books, but yeah, we won't go with that.
No, but books where you can pull a page over with your hand. I think the other thing about Facebook, I don't think Facebook's going to decline. I think there's a signal here that Facebook's going to lose its momentum. But while if it loses its momentum with a certain group of individuals in the West, it's catching. It's going. You've got all of India and China and the rest of it to go at. Yeah. So it's not going to go away soon.
Except they have their own,
don't they?
They have their own social networks, and you know, and Google Plus is coming on, taking over.
Yeah.
And there seems to be in social networks, you know, a cycle of growth and death.
I think that's right. And you do it with everything, doesn't it? I mean, it's whatever it is.
Who would have thought Microsoft would have...
Yeah, sure.
You say it was... I'm going to bite my lip, okay. Otherwise we'll get into technology.
Yeah, let's not go there. Staying with Facebook, though, and I want to bring in this prediction. Another prediction is that Facebook's going to get... It's going to ruin more marriages. It's already happening, and there was lawyers in the UK, for example, are finding that up to one in five of all divorce petitions now are citing Facebook. So you've got a big rise in Facebook being the vehicle by which people are cheating, male and female. And this shouldn't take us by surprise, and it shouldn't take me by surprise, but I am surprised at the speed at which this has happened, because Facebook's a fairly recent phenomena, the way in which it's expanded. But it's the fact that it's now being cited increasingly in divorces as a reason for the divorce, i.e. my partner met someone on Facebook, was cheating consequently. In whatever way Facebook's being brought in, it's being mentioned in an increasing number of divorce petitions in the UK and the USA. And the extreme of it is one example I'm going to give here, which was in 2011. This is not Facebook, but it's to do with social networking or the electoral world, if you like. In 2011, a woman divorced her husband because she found he was involved in a virtual affair on cyberspace with someone he'd never met. So you've got the virtual world where cheating's taking place. But then again, you've got to ask yourself, well, is it cheating if he's never met her? This woman clearly thought so. I have to say, I think that's a bit of an extreme response to someone having some sort of virtual affair in Second Life. But nevertheless, this woman took it forward, and there you go. So a rise in electro babble and a rise in Facebook being involved in adulterous relationships, but also maybe a rise in the number of young people who get bored by it and see that it find it shallow and want to go back to some more intellectually rigorous pastime like reading a book.
Stephen, was that example in Japan?
Facebook.
Do you remember?
No, because I heard one in Japan.
Where that's happened, and there's even been violence. I think there was somebody that was somebody killed somebody else as a result of that. But do we actually blame the internet? You don't blame the internet. It's just another way of communicating. It's like blaming the Royal Mail.
Absolutely. You know. Yeah. No, I don't. I agree. I don't blame Facebook for that. How can you? I mean, I think in that instance where the woman's instigated a divorce because of husband's. I mean, some virtual refer. I think cyberspace. I mean, I think the woman needs help, not the husband. I mean, there's obviously something in the marriage, but that's marriages, that's relationships. Mm. He's going out. I mean, better for him if he wants to do it in cyberspace. Personally, I wouldn't be bothered. I'd go out into real life if I wanted it, and that's what a lot of men would do. But she's got a husband who didn't want to do that, and if she divorces him. But people make their own decisions. I don't blame Facebook. I think in that case, I think the woman's being rather hard. It's her choice. Mm. I think it cuts to something else, which I'm going to talk about. It's another prediction, which is we're going to see a decline in marriage. We're emerging. 2012, I think, will be more debates about the emergence of what I'm calling the post-marriage society. Marriage is going to go into decline. Fewer young people are going to venture into it because of the risks or the financial commitments that's come with it. There's no need to. More and more kids are being born out of wedlock anyway. The old stigma around being single have gone completely. But at the same time, there's this big need for what sociologist Anthony Giddens called a pure relationship, which is invested solely in love. But the problem with that, of course, is once the love goes, or the love appears to go, then people get out of the relationship. There's no commitment for the long term. So that's another prediction. We're going to see this decline in marriage.
I'm not surprised, Stephen. You've been saying this for 43 episodes.
Yeah, sure.
I'm
not the only person saying it now, though. And it's interesting, more and more, there's more books coming out on this, and more research being done to show it. So it's no longer just a personal position where I'm trying to promote the decline of marriage. We're saying this is reality, really. The other thing we're going to see, another prediction, we're going to see an increase in domestic violence. And I predict this is particularly the case because of economic and social pressures. Economic pressures on families, social pressures in changing roles between men and women. And families, particularly in the UK, I think, and the States, not being able to cope with this. And it was it was sad, wasn't it? In the UK over Christmas, 20 people were murdered.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, 20 people murdered, and that's just people murdered. This is stuff that got into the news.
That's right, murdered in their own homes.
Usually murdered by friends or lovers or husbands. Well, one family of three wiped out by one guy in Peterlee in north of England, northeast England, and then he killed himself.
And you think these were crimes of passion, or?
I think the crimes of frustration, anger, frustration, desperation. There may be some psychological issues. Is working away here as well. And then, of course, you've got the stabbing in Oxford Street, which was a not domestic-related thing, but it seemed to be some sort of random gang killing, a young guy killed. And there was Manchester on Boxing Day, a student from, where was he from? Turkey, I think. He was just walking along one of the main streets in Manchester, and some young Mancunian, white guy, came up and blasted a hole in his head with a gun. For no reason whatsoever. That guy's been arrested now, but the poor family in Turkey, absolutely devastated. He was a student at Lancaster University. Just a random killing for no reason whatsoever. It was execution style.
The effect of your prediction so far is I'm going to buy a padlock the front gate and never leave the house.
Well, you're right in sharing mine. Yeah.
provided you're not driving.
The other the other prediction is that there's going to be further economic and social marginalisation of men. Again, it's something I've been touching on during the year, and I don't see that changing. Won't lay
Can
too
you
much
explain that, marginalising of men?
Well, it's marginalising because they're not going to get work, they're not going to get relationships, they're not going to be they're going to be surplus to social requirements. They have nothing to bring to the table, they've got nothing to offer, and they are reduced to being in gangs to get some form of self-esteem. Do I need to go on?
I am enjoying this episode so far. Thank you very much. Welcome to the new year. An hour.
Let's get on to a nice one, a good one.
Please.
Certain group of men, we're going to see a growth in the underclass. That's true. But on the good side, another good one is an increase in the number of open relationships. This is going to happen, but it's slow. I know it's slowing. It's slow at the moment, but it's building up. And again, it's something we're seeing around the world, particularly though in the West.
Sorry, open relationships again, meaning?
I mean, some contract or negotiation or compromise been made by both partners, and we're talking gay or state relationships, whereby one or both can go off and have other relationships under some form of qualification, i.e. you either tell me or I don't want to know about it, whatever the couple work out for themselves. Now, that's what I call an open relationship. We're going to see a lot more of that. And the other interesting thing, and the good news, that although we're seeing an increase in the number of divorces and a decline in the marriage, we're not seeing an increase in the number of divorces for infidelity. That's not happening. Infidelity, unfaithfulness, cheating, what I call it what you will, is becoming less and less important in terms of triggering a divorce. What is increasingly triggering divorces is just where couples feel they've grown apart. They've got less in common. The love's become undermined. They are not, they've lost the friendship, maybe. So more open marriages, and I think that's links with what I said earlier about more openness in towards lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people. A general more open sexual attitudes are going to prevail in society, and there's absolutely no way of stopping that. And I don't, you know, I'm sorry, Americans, it don't matter how many Republicans get elected next time, it's just, you're just not going to stop this trend. It's definitely not going to happen.
Oh, are the Republicans, I'm really not up to date with all the pros and cons of the different parties. The Republicans are very pro-weddings, are they?
The Republicans are conservative. To put it in the dualism, if you like, put it like this. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan got on famously. So you've got the head of the Conservative Party, Prime Minister, an ardent radical conservative, liberal, neoliberalist in terms of economics. Didn't want big government, wanted free market economy. And you've got Reagan, ex-film star, becomes president of the United States. Same sort of value system. Republican. They are. The Republicans are deeply conservative and often deeply traditional and often deeply nasty. But there's also a group of them who are, you know, clever, see the world in a more enlightened way, but just want more liberal economics policies. But then on the Democrat side, you've got people like Clinton, you've got Obama, you've got Kennedy, you've got a different history. But then again, the Democrats can also produce someone like Lyndon B. Johnson, you know, who was hardly considered to be a liberal. But so it's complicated. But basically, the Republicans tend to be more conservative, more reactionary against.
There'll never be an open relationship in the White House, will they? You wouldn't get in on it. Anyway, I'm distracting you.
I think you probably did have a couple of. You've had a couple of open relationships in the White House, and the one that comes to mind, and I think the biographers now have recognised it, was the one between Jackie Kennedy and what?
And Mr. Kennedy.
I forget his first name.
Robert.
Robert. Yeah, no, it wasn't.
Not Robert, yeah.
What was it?
Anyway.
Okay.
Listeners know, and they'll what are these two guys been drinking before the podcast?
Yeah, Kennedy present and his wife. I think because he had an affair with Marilyn Monroe and a few others, didn't he? But I think that was the nearest he probably got to an open relationship that's come out so far in the biographies. What other predictions? You're going to see an increase in the number of cross-cultural relationships. Again, this is something we're going to podcast on in the future. But relationships, gay or straight, where the two partners come from different cultural backgrounds, maybe different religions, maybe different nationalities, but predominantly different cultures. And that's, again, a consequence of globalization, the internet, people traveling, connecting. Yeah. And that's wonderful, and that's great. You know, it's a positive one, and you know, let's welcome that. But it does bring its own issues, and we're going to look at that in the future. Probably linking to that is coming up to penultimate prediction, which is an increasing number of Westerners coming to live in Asia. There's a bunch of reasons for it, and I think whether they're gay or straight, I think there's a lot of Westerners have attracted to what we've talked before in previous podcasts about the Asian mystique, the particular types of gender performances that go on here, a more openness, if you like, around sexuality and sexual behaviour, and even though there's a deep conservatism operating in nature at the same time over relationships and male and female roles. So I can, and then of course there's the economics of it. I think for a lot of Westerners coming and living out here, retirement is a big attraction.
It's affordable.
Yes, and yes. Then there's a lot of young people I think are going to be coming out here. I've got two sons who are living out here out of choice now, because that's what they feel the future's here, and you know, they're learning Mandarin and they're developing careers here. And finally, after all that, what can I say?
It must be a plus.
Big plus is absolutely, and it's the big plus is going to be an increased demand for people like me, relationship counsellors.
You came prepped with that, didn't you? That's I like that. That was very good. And as listeners can guess, I had no idea what he was going to say. Just like every other podcast that we do, that's a very good one. Actually, it's a good. Okay. Right, well, that's after 40 minutes, that's probably a good place to end. The blog is it really? No, I'm not going to quite end on that. I'm just going to end on the on two small points. One of them is we're not going to get to the end of 2012 according to the Mayan race.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about this.
You know, it's going to be the end of the world anyway in 2012.
Mm. Somebody asked me about this seriously the other day here, really? In Thailand, yeah.
This part of the world is full of superstition and beliefs on this. All I'll add to that is if the Mayans were so good at predicting the future, how come they're all dead now, right? which is a good one. And the only other thing, Stephen, is a request, really, a personal request. And my personal request is, please, please, do not tell Nong about chemical castration. She knows nothing about it, and as she prepares most of the food in the house, please don't tell her about this.
I'll know if your voice starts rising.
Thank you.
Over the next 6 months,
right?
And you're spending more time indoors. I know something's going on. Okay, Chris.
And the blog's at relationshipmanifesto.postres.com.
My wife's a scientist. She's the one who could work it out.
Really? You probably just.
Fortunately, neither of our wives listen to the podcast.
Well, yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, fortunately, from that point of view, for that one. And readers, don't send us any recipes to our wives or anything like that, or suggestions by any means, any means possible. Do not send that. And that's it. This is our first podcast in 2012.
Yeah. Welcome to the new year.
The book's still available.
Yeah.
On Amazon, and I'm so frustrated about this. It's almost in the Apple iTunes store. I'm just waiting for one last bit of information you need to present to Apple to put it up there. I'm hoping in the next week when we meet again next, Stephen. I'm hoping that
great.
It's up there then. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
This recording is part of a Relationship Manifesto podcast series with Chris Smith and Stephen Whitehead.